Listen, think about, contemplate Buddha's teachings, and that includes me. Even though I'm talking and Siliana's talking, we're listening as well, processing it, trying to hear the advice in it, so we can develop our amazing potential, so we can help others. That's it. So just giving a very brief, so far a brief overview. The aim is to look into this marvelous practice, this advanced practice, of how to use difficulties in our life to make them valuable for us, not an obstacle, you know. How to transform problems into happiness. As Lama Zopa says, we'll have to learn to like problems like we like ice cream. So when we analyze that, it's a very shocking concept, you know. It's like literally to reverse the usual way we automatically think about life. We know the second something goes wrong, that's what we call a problem. So when we hear that the Buddha says it's really intelligent to see it as good, initially it's like insane. It's like mental, it's like demented, ridiculous. What do you mean, you know? So what we do to go here is give some background to this. Look at the logic of this, you know. So if we understand also this transforming problems into happiness is part of the compassion wing, it's one of the major techniques to help us smash ego grasping, all the disturbing emotions, because they, on the compassion wing, they are the obstacle that prevent us from really being helpful to others, from really having incredible compassion, you know. So to understand that, we have to understand high school and junior school. Because it's in high school we learn in depth about the mind and how it functions. This is Buddha's key way of presenting the way the mind works, and it's unique to the Buddha. And then before we even do that, before we begin to work on our mind, high school, we've got to go to junior school. And this is, you know, this is where we have to learn about karma, although the essential practice here is to learn the discipline of controlling our body and speech. So the key point about this Lam Rim, this presentation of Tsongkhapa, this way of presenting, a packaging of all of Buddha's teachings, he took the essence from all the vast body of knowledge, all the metaphysics, all the philosophy, all the psychology, you know, and he took the essential points and put them in an orderly way, orderly in terms of the capacity of the student. Just like I said before, in any body of knowledge that you're learning, that's how you study it. But the key factor, his agenda in presenting these teachings isn't just as interesting philosophical presentations, but he gets us to see the experiential component of it. And it's all to energize us to want to practice, you know. It's very sort of psychologically sound. But initially, of course, when you hear it in a traditional way, you can't see that. I mean, I remember when I first heard the teachings from Lama Zopa, the Lam Rim. I sat there for 1 month. Part of me knew this was what I wanted, but another part, I was utterly confused. I did not know what he was talking about. I kept saying to myself, where's the Buddhism here? All I could hear was this bizarre, arcane, 14th century ideas. I had no idea what he was talking about. I couldn't get my head around it. So I think it just takes us time, you know, to really get the essential, experiential, psychological point from why the Lam Rim is presented in the way it's presented, you know. It takes us time, I think. Okay. So in order to transform a problem, to see a problem as good, we have to analyze what a problem is. So what a problem is, if we look into the Four Noble Truths, this presentation, Buddha's first teaching about what suffering is and what causes it and how to get rid of it. In the Second Noble Truth, like I said, he presents the two main causes for our suffering. We can also, recognize from that, you can say the same about happiness. Two main causes of our happiness. And this is based on the view of our mind being not physical, of our mind going back before this life, previous, back. This view is based on that concept. The idea of karma really doesn't work if the consciousness doesn't go before this life. As Dalai Lama said, karma is like self-creation, you know. It's a very interesting way of putting it. So we're trying to transform a problem. We're trying to see a problem as good. We need to know how you define a problem. So a problem is called suffering. And suffering, the first level of suffering is the suffering of suffering. And that's very simple, like I mentioned. That's what everyone accepts as suffering. And basically, simply, it's when the bad things happen. So to understand that, then we have to understand the causes. That helps us. So we understand the causes in the second noble truth, and we look at the second cause, which is really the main one, these unhappy states of mind, these disturbing emotions, the way they say it in the text, the so-called afflictions, you know, these disturbing emotions, these ridiculous, neurotic, disturbed, exaggerated, distorted states of mind. They are the source, the main cause of suffering. The main cause. Now, this alone, we could spend the next week just on this concept, because this is absolutely not what we think, and it is absolutely not what neuroscience teaches. It's not what science teaches. It's not what the world thinks, you know. But this is Buddha's point. And it's pretty shocking. It's pretty outrageous. So he is saying that what goes on in our mind is the main source of happiness and suffering. It's a very simple statement. What goes on in our mind is the main source of happiness and suffering. So we all know, even if we're good Buddhists, we've been practicing this for years and studying it, we all know, we know these words, but we don't act like it. We blame the other person. We blame the next door neighbour. We blame our nun friend. We blame the director of the centre. We blame our mum. We just do it automatically because this is very instinctive. This is the samsaric philosophy. And it's very natural, and everybody in the universe thinks this way. The monkey does it. The dog does it. Everybody assumes when you feel something in here that isn't what you want, which is called suffering, you look for something out there. Why are you sick? Oh, why are you unhappy? The boyfriend. Why are you unhappy? The director of the center didn't give me my job properly. Whatever it might be, it's automatic. It's automatic because these habits are primordially deep in us. This analysis is very deep. We do not question it, you know. So to do this, we need to look into the Buddha's view of how the mind works. If it's the main cause of our suffering, we had better know exactly his view of how the mind works. So like I said, you know, we began looking into the mind. First of all, the mind works in two ways. Like I said, it mentioned before. And there's two ways you learn about the mind. When you study the mind in more depth, you learn first the epistemological model of the mind, which is the way mind functions. And this is totally fascinating. Because we're not discussing the brain here. We're discussing the actual way our own cognitive process functions. This is not physical. We're discussing mental here. We don't have an equivalent of this, I think, in our science. So, then there are two ways our mind functions. This is already really fascinating, and this already points very clearly to the way Buddha describes what our problems are. I always use the same example, you know. I might say, that's a very pretty cup. I might say that. Just say, good example. So without any question, nobody would disagree that this is what's happening. I look over here, my eyes are open, I see that thing, I then say, what a pretty cup. So we all assume, without question, that my eyes are seeing a pretty cup. This feels fairly reasonable. We don't question that. Buddha says, don't be ridiculous. It's not possible. Don't be absurd. What's happening here? Well, we've got sensory consciousness and we have mental. Sensory consciousness and mental. So sensory, as Lama Geshe says, we make the body the boss. We know ourselves in our lives. Our sensory experiences dominate us. They are huge in our life. The smallest pain in your knee, you can be overwhelmed all day. The smallest, you know, pleasant sensation, you can feel so excited. We are so driven by our sensory conscious experiences. We're addicted to only wanting the nice ones. So we judge our happiness and suffering, honestly, mostly on our sensory experiences. Well, Buddha says we're grossly misrepresenting them. We're grossly misinterpreting them. We are over-exaggerating their function. It's so important, if we want to understand the way Buddha's talking, to understand these things, you know. So sensory consciousness is the five, eye consciousness, ear consciousness, etc. Remember the word consciousness is not physical, mind is not physical. So to spell it out, we would say my eye consciousness, which is that part of my mind, which is not physical, that functions through the medium of the eyeball, the eyelid, all the nerves working beautifully. There's that. So there's the consciousness, all the physical bits, speaking roughly, and then you have the external object. Well, the object, the mind always cognizes something. Every moment of our cognition, each has its own particular thing that it cognizes, the object. Well, here in the case of eye consciousness, the only thing that eye consciousness is capable of cognizing is shape and color. They're profoundly limited in their capacity for cognition. Shape and color. So you logically must ask the question, what part of my mind is cognizing a pretty cup? Well, that's your mental consciousness. That's where the workshop is. That's what we have to learn to become familiar with. This is Buddha's expertise, his knowledge about the workings of the mind coming from these amazing Indians before him. The internal process, not the brain. So what's happening is this. My eyes go here. And then because the Buddha says, and this is like Lama Zopa said it like this, that every second of the day, it's like we're taking photos all day automatically and all of the images are stored in our mind. Nothing goes astray. Nothing disappears. From, you know, we don't remember most of it, but it's all stored there. And this is from life after life after life, these billions of images of like memories basically. So what's happening is this. My eye consciousness goes here. It triggers instantaneously. What it does... What's the problem down there? Some drama? Okay. All good? Nothing's wrong? Something's wrong? What's happened? What? The radio doesn't work. Okay. Good. Okay. Are we communicating here? I'll start again. So eye consciousness goes here. Eyes go here. It sees shape and color. And then quicker, this is true, quicker than Google, this is really true, quicker than Google, my mental consciousness is accessed, where the few memories I have remembered, you know, the cups I like, it's a cup, it's this, it's pretty, I like that, I don't like this, all these, in other words, everything, and this is the point now, everything in our mental consciousness is a series of concepts, a series of thoughts, a series of viewpoints, opinions. That's what our mental consciousness consists of. Billions of opinions, of ideas, of opinions, of viewpoints. This is really very sobering, you know? So, of course, we programmed our mind in these viewpoints, and we don't think it's a viewpoint. I don't think it's an opinion. If I'm very stubborn and proud, I will think I'm speaking the truth. Of course it's a pretty cup. And if you say it's not, you're stupid. Well, look how we all live our lives. It's how we live, you know. Whatever happens in our mental consciousness, we assume we're right. We believe it totally. There's a bunch of opinions, a bunch of conceptual stories. And we've been programming ourselves with the conceptual stories, Buddha says, for many, many lifetimes. So some of those conceptual stories are neurotic, deluded, eye-based, fear-based, disturbing, delusional, ridiculous, the source of our pain and misconceptions. The next lot are valid concepts. They are valid. They're valid cognitions. We know those. Love, compassion, kindness. They are at the core of our being. And all the trouble is, though, they are mixed like a big soup. And we can't tell one bit from another. But this is our job as a Buddhist, to begin to distinguish between the crazy bits and the valid bits. And this is a massively difficult job because they all come together virtually, you know. And they're so quick. And we've had them for so long. And the negative ones, the unhappy ones, the delusional ones, the ridiculous ones are so ingrained. And we believe these stories. This is the way Buddha's talking. This is how he talks about our mind, you know. It's very fascinating. A bunch of opinions in here. So basically our job is we need to distinguish in the mind, another way of putting it, we have to distinguish in the mind between the facts and the fictions. So there's many misconceptions in our mind, Buddha's saying. The ones we're dealing with here are the ones that have got the emotional component, like anger, attached, at least three we discussed. The two, basically. From 84,000 down to three. The root one, ignorance, known colloquially as ego grasping, ignorance, literally ignorance, ignorance about how the I and everything else exists, the root ignorance, known colloquially as ego grasping. That's the one that's primordially deep, that drives everything. And then effectively on the basis of that, the main one in daily life that is the source of all our suffering. And until we understand this very deeply, attachment, we won't understand how we are suffering and why, and we won't understand how others are suffering, so we can't have valid compassion, and we certainly will not be able to transform a problem into happiness. It's based on understanding attachment and aversion. These two main, effectively, on the basis, these three, toxic emotions, the summary of all the 84,000. If we can understand these, on the face of it, they sound so simple. In the way we talk in our culture, you know, we don't talk like this. We give fancy names to our psychological problems. Well, Buddha keeps it real simple, you know. These are our main psychological problems. And attachment, effectively, is the reason day to day that we suffer. And from attachment, it gives rise to aversion. So these two are fundamental to understand if we want to be, a Buddhist. So, okay, the suffering of suffering is when the bad things happen. If we look at the causes of suffering and we see it's karma and all the neurotic states of mind, and we start to look at these neurotic states of mind, this first category, the misconceptions, the disturbing emotions, the so-called afflictions, then we'll understand what a problem is. So basically, when we understand attachment is this multifaceted, primordially deep misconception, disturbing emotion. Something so automatic and so natural that the way we tend to think of what Buddha means by it in our life, we just think it's normal. We don't even think of it as a problem unless it's extreme attachment. We don't think attachment is a problem until you're a junkie, until you're attached to eating food and you become 500 kilos, until if you're attached to jumping on 25 boys a day, then we think you've got a problem with attachment. But no, Buddha says itself is a mental illness. Itself is a primordially deep misconception and delusion. But because it's so pervasive among all beings, because everybody's got it, we of course assume it's normal. And it is normal insofar as we have it, but it's a mental illness for the Buddha. You know, it's quite shocking to hear this. So we have to understand it. Lama Yeshe said, I could tell you about attachment for one whole year. We would never begin to understand it, you know. So it's multifaceted. For the first most primordial level of attachment, like attachment energy, and this is from having practiced it in countless lives, we're born with this primordially deep dissatisfaction. As Lama Zopa says, you know, it's the main pain in our culture in the West. Constantly thinking, I haven't got enough. I am not enough. I don't have enough. I haven't achieved enough. How much my boyfriend tells me he loves me, it's never enough. It's just an assumption so deep inside, and it's incredible pain. And of course, because it's so primordial, we truly believe it's true. That is the worst crime we have. We assume it's true. Because we feel it, we believe it. This is our worst thing in our culture. If we feel something, we assume it's true. We never analyze. We never question. And this is what Buddha's demanding we do, you know. So dissatisfaction is the fundamental energy of attachment. Then on the basis of this, naturally, because you're dissatisfied, then you're hankering, you're craving for something, and because you truly believe when I get that something, it will fill up the hole and will stop the dissatisfaction. It's automatic. It's natural. And the most obvious place this attachment looks is in the world outside, which is the objects of the five senses, basically. The objects of tactile consciousness, taste consciousness, ear consciousness, eye consciousness, and nose consciousness. And obviously some are much more strong than others, you know. But it's the world we occupy. And of course, because this attachment is so deep, the hunger is like emotional hunger. Is so deep, the second we wake up in the morning, we're constantly, this is what attachment's job is, it's searching all the time for something to make sure we get that one. Because when we get it, we assume that's what happiness is. And now what happens when attachment doesn't get what it wants? Or when attachment gets what it doesn't want? And that's 1,000 times a day. And that's called aversion, the third one. So then attachment, it's constant dissatisfaction, emotional hunger, craving, and then you get the object, you manipulate to get it, you control, you manipulate, you expect, and then you exaggerate its role in making you happy, and then you possess it as mine. And all this is completely spontaneous. We've practiced it to perfection for countless lifetimes. This is what drives all the animals. Look, no one has to learn this. We just get born with it because we've practiced it before. We're expert at it. So we never question. That's the point. We never question it. And this is what's so hard, to start to look into our assumptions. So the one way of summarizing, and it's kind of brutal, this attachment, it's this unbelievable vampire, this frantic, hungry vampire inside us, every millisecond, constantly frantic to get only the nice things. Attachment can only stand the nice things. It can only bear the nice things. And what does the nice thing mean? It means it can only bear what I want. It's the main voice of I. It's a primordially, totally self-centered, hungry little vampire. And it is frantic to get what I want every millisecond. That's it. Of course, it sounds so shocking because we don't see it so brutally. We can see it in some people. And this is the point, because our saving grace is our virtues. We have got access to love and patience and kindness and forgiveness and generosity and compassion, and they are our good qualities. So the irony is they make it harder to see our attachment, you know. If you can see a person who just mainly has attachment, it's really obvious why they're suffering. They're a monster because they can't access much love or compassion. Attachment is this junkie to get what I want every second. It can't bear any problems. This is the point. It can't stand anything going wrong. We become crazy. Attachment makes us crazy when we can't get what we want. We can see this. This is what drives samsara. So then the third one, that gives rise to the third one. The millisecond attachment is thwarted. The millisecond attachment doesn't get what it wants. The millisecond attachment gets what it doesn't want. That's the arising of aversion. So that's multifaceted also. The obvious volatile level of aversion is called anger. Pretty clear. Look at the kid. Screaming, shouting, tears coming out the eyes, spit coming out the mouth, fists flailing. The person's having a mental breakdown. We go, oh, they're just angry. Look at it. It's complete mental collapse. Why? Because attachment just didn't get what it wanted. I mean, we should be embarrassed. But we call it normal. Buddha says, I'm sorry, it's why you're suffering, baby. It's evident when we think about it this way. So then the volatile level, the obvious one, is called anger. That's when you harm others as well, you know. But this is the point. The trouble is there are milder versions of this anger, but we just don't pay attention. We don't think it's important. And they're called irritation, annoyance, upset, stressed, anxious, worried. They're all variations of aversion, and they're thwarted attachment. Attachment not getting what it wants. When attachment gets what it wants, we're all excited and perky, you know, all happy. Everything's lovely, you know. But the second something goes wrong, going wrong means attachment not getting what it wants. This sounds very brutal. This is not the analysis we do in our culture. This is Buddha's analysis. And this is internal, completely internal. We have to know our minds. So if we look at transforming a problem, you know, way up at the higher end of compassion wing, university, you look at the smallest, look at the small problems we have, you know, that we all make mountains of. As our mothers say in English, we make mountains out of molehills. That's what attachment does. That's what anger does. It sounds very shocking. And this has got nothing to do, this anger has got, and the attachment, in terms of their causing me suffering, have got nothing to do whether, about, nothing to do with whether the person who did in fact harm me is right or wrong. No. We're not discussing the person. In our culture, we're so addicted to blaming the external event, which gives us a reason to think, oh, now we know why I'm angry and I'm allowed to be angry. You know, we feel bad if we just get angry about nothing. But if someone punches us in the nose, we think it's good to be angry. So we always looking for a reason to show, but that's why I'm angry. I'm allowed to be angry. That's why I'm jealous. I'm allowed to be jealous. That's why I'm depressed. I'm allowed to be depressed. Because ego is frantic to, we say in the English, we're frantic to get off the hook, not to be responsible. It's very strong. Ego's like that. So this is very kind of courageous practice. It's owning what goes on in our mind regardless of what the other person did. They might be a monster. Agreed. That's not the issue here. This is why this is really intense, you know. But we link our emotions so strongly to the external event. And if the external event is that bad, then we feel it's okay to be angry. It's okay to be jealous. It's okay to be depressed. This is not my fault. That's how we feel. So it seems very brutal to think this way. But this is the, you know, this is the only way we're going to really change is by owning my anger is mine. My jealousy is mine. My attachment is mine. And then when we begin to understand karma, we even have a logical reason for why that bad thing happened. That we don't have in the materialist view. That we don't have in the Christian teachings. I don't know what the Christian teachings say. Maybe it's just God's will. That's okay. But the Buddha's view is we even create the cause to have that happen. So this is really powerful analysis that we're not used to thinking. And it takes enormous practice to do this. So the more we know this in high school and junior school, karma and working on the mind, the more we're able to practice this properly. Now we can begin to comprehend the logic of how it's possible in the advanced stages of practice to be happy about having problems, to be glad to greet a problem. Bring them on. I'm ready for them. And why is it good to see bad things as good? Because the reason we're suffering, the Buddha says in the Second Noble Truth, and we learn about this in high school, the reason we're suffering is because of our delusions. So if every time you meet a problem, which means it's what your attachment doesn't want, and every time you greet a problem, you just put an atomic bomb under attachment. Wow, fantastic. That's why it's good to, you know, transform problems into happiness. But you won't know that until you've done high school and junior school. So it's not possible. It's like you'd be seen as mentally ill if you think a problem is good, if you don't understand the logic of it, you know. It's not that easy, but there's logic to it. We have to understand the logic by studying it. Understanding what attachment is, understanding what aversion is, these simple, simple words. This is the base of Buddhist psychology, the essence, you know. And all the other dramas come from these. Depression. No, the anger is multifaceted. Like, yeah, I began telling. That's multifaceted. So anger is the obvious one. Volatile, shout, yell. The milder versions in daily life, annoyed, like I said, irritated, upset, stressed, frustrated. You know, you don't go to your therapist, oh, I got frustrated today. They'll tell you to shut up and go home. They only want to hear if you want to kill your husband or yourself. In other words, we don't even think that anger's a problem unless it's screaming and shouting. Or, finally, the internalized version of aversion is guilt and despair and depression. Depression is internalized aversion. It's very simple. But we don't pay attention to these things until it's too late. This is one of our major problems in our culture. What Buddha's saying is not that complicated. That we can learn to harness the energy of our mind. We can learn to know our mind. We can learn to be in control of our thoughts and feelings and emotions, even at a fairly gross level. But our major problem is we don't notice them until they're too late. That's our problem. That's a big problem. It's a major problem. In other words, I use a really simple analogy, you know. Like if you've never heard of car mechanics, you've never heard of such a thing, and you just get a brand new car and you just drive it and drive it and drive it and drive it, and things start to fall off and break, and then one day you're driving at 180 kilometres on the autostrada or whatever it's called, and, oh, my wheels are falling off. What will I do? Well, it's a bit late, but you've never heard of mechanics. And this is a stupid analogy, but it's very profound. We know perfectly well you've got to maintain your car. You need to be aware of the wheels wobbling well before they fall off. And if you do that, you will never have wheels fall off your car because you're in charge of it. That's our mind, but we never pay attention to our mind until the wheels are falling off. We don't pay attention to our aversion until you want to kill yourself or kill your boyfriend. That's the wheels falling off. We don't even notice until then. That's what Buddha's suggesting. It's very practical. We can learn, first of all, controlling our body and speech in junior school, and we'll talk about this. Then we can begin to do a bit of meditation, start to step out of our head and begin to pay attention in daily life to what on earth is going on inside here. And that's the essence of the job of being a Buddhist. Yes, you've got to practice it on your cushion. That's not the only time. 90% of the time, we are not on our cushion. We're behind the wheel of the car. We're dealing with the children, with the husband, with the colleagues at work. And because we are so addicted, because of attachment, to the outside world, and because attachment has the assumption when the boss is nice and the people are friendly and the weather's good and the food is lovely and the body is comfortable, then I'm happy. The second something wrong happens, we get upset and we blame the external, but we're not paying attention here. That's the job we have to learn to do. That's Buddha's expertise. And this is the hardest job because it demands we have to pay, look here every moment and label what is there and own it as your own. This is hard. This is being a Buddhist. That's being a Buddhist. Wearing our nun's robes is not being a Buddhist. Saying our mantras is not being a Buddhist. You know, doing prostrations is not being a Buddhist. Walking around a stupa is not being a Buddhist. Working on your mind is when you become a Buddhist. That's the essential job. That's it. You do these other things to support that job. This is being a Buddhist. Being your own therapist, as Lama Yeshe said. And everything flows from that. All your success in practice flows from that, you know. So there's ego grasping, ignorance, mat-rigpa, unawareness, which is the root affliction, the root mental illness, the root misconception. And we'll deal with that later. But on the basis of that, effectively in daily life, the main source, the main voice, if you like, of ego grasping is attachment. You know, attachment. Hunger, emotional hunger, dissatisfaction, emotional hunger, not having enough, manipulating, craving, controlling, trying to get, believing 100 billion% when attachment gets what it wants, that will kind of relieve the pain, basically. Stop the pain, you know. But Buddha's analyzed it in so many ways that we have to learn to understand, to recognize that it's the misconceptions in there, all the misconceptions in there. Because all Buddha's saying, contact with attachment objects does trigger pleasure. No one argues with that. We know when you taste the cake, it's a pleasant feeling. When you, you know, talk to your boyfriend and he's looking at you kindly and he gives you a hug, it triggers a pleasant feeling. When, you know, the weather is pleasant, it gives a pleasant feeling. No argument. It's true. And that's what happiness is. So, okay, back to what we said before. Remember the model of the mind? In Buddhist view of the mind, we can divide all the contents of our mental consciousness into three categories. The first is the neurotic, negative, disturbing, non-virtuous, ridiculous, fear-based, painful states of mind. The second lot are the valid ones, virtuous, reasonable, beneficial, useful. The third lot, speaking simply, they're called negative, positive, neutral. But neutral is very misleading. It sounds like not meaning, not important. It's not the meaning here. It's really specific. This third lot, I like to call them the mechanics of our mind. Think about this. They are what cause us to function properly. You've got the neuroses and you have the good qualities. Then you've got all the mechanics like concentration, intention, attention, discrimination, good memory, alertness. There's so many of these. And when they are working properly, whether you're a murderer or a meditator, you will do the job well. So that's in that sense, these are neither virtuous nor non-virtuous, but they have a very powerful function. They're very necessary. This virtuous and non-virtuous is Buddha's very specific way of identifying the function of these different states of mind. So the negative ones cause us suffering. The positive ones cause us happiness. The third lot enable us to do whatever we're going to do. So one of those, of course, is called mindfulness. I don't know what the Italian word is. But in English, it's like another religion. People practically invented a new religion, you know. But actually, it's just one of these mechanics. It's simply the capacity to not forget what you're doing moment by moment. That's it. The ability to not forget what you're doing moment by moment. But for some reason, it's become this huge meaning in the West. We've added all these bells and whistles onto it. It's just ridiculous. It's the ability to not forget what you're doing. Like if you're making a cake and you forgot what you were doing. That's because you haven't got this called mindfulness. That's what it means. It's not virtuous and it's not non-virtuous. It's practical. It's essential. And that's why Lama Zopa says thieves need mindfulness. It's just good memory, that's all. We make it all this extra stuff, you know. It's just one necessary part of our mind to do anything properly. And clearly, with single point of concentration, the major component we're trying to train is that one, the capacity to not forget what you're doing. That helps your mind become concentrated. We so misunderstand it in the West, you know. And the mechanics of the mind. And they are trained in single point of concentration. They make us ingenious, brilliant. And we use them. We use this clarity and mindfulness and concentration and discrimination to help us distinguish every second of the day between the virtues and the non-virtues. That's the job of being a Buddhist. So this is radically different, you know. We're so familiar with the materialist model. And what does that do? In that model, what do? The main thing we think about is the external thing. You know, even if we say, tell me about your happiness. I'm happy, let's say. Why are you happy, Rabina? Tell me about your happiness. And I will give you a detailed description of what my boyfriend did. Kind, loving, compassionate, generous. If you think of that happiness, you have a pleasant feeling, you're visualizing the external event. Suffering, same. What happened, Rabina? Tell me about your suffering. I'll give you a detailed description of my boyfriend's bad words. And when I'm thinking of my suffering, I'm thinking of him. It's like a movie in my head. We all know this. So it's the outside world that we point to. If you're angry, tell me about your anger. I'll give you a detailed description of my boyfriend. No, don't tell me about your boyfriend, Rabina. Tell me about your anger and I'll repeat my story. We don't even know what it means, describe anger. I'll describe the boyfriend seen through the lenses of my anger. That's how we work. We're schizophrenic, as Lama Yeshe put it. We're all the time obsessed with the outside, blaming the outside, identifying the outside as the problem. And that's how we think in the West. When I go to my therapist and I'll talk about my anger or my depression, what should we do? We'll look back into the past. Events, what mummy did, what daddy did. We'll look at my genes, my DNA, what my last boyfriend did, what my Catholic nuns did. We'll look at all the external events because that's our analysis in the West. We look for the causes of why I am now in the past events. And then we look at the DNA, the genes and the brain and all the rest. Buddha says, that's fine, you can do that, but you're not looking at the problem, baby. The problem is the mind. It's so shocking, so simple, it's embarrassing. Even good Buddhists, we forget it. The mind is called anger. It's called love. It's called compassion. And it's a concept and it's a habit. And it thinks a certain story. And then we believe the story. That's it. That's what's going on. That's the analysis we have to do. This is intense work. Intense work. Rigorous, clear, courageous work. The boyfriend's, that's his problem. He's shouting, he's yelling, his abuse. This is not being horrible. It's immoral. There's no argument. Buddha agrees that if he punches you and beats you, that's wrong. Nobody argues with that. But that's his problem. What's yours, babe? We can't hear that at all. It's too painful. And the same with our happiness. Why are you happy, Rabina? Oh, my boyfriend's so kind to me. So in other words, I blame him for my suffering and I blame him for my happiness. That's how addicted we are to the outside world. We blame the outside world, the events, the things, the people, the brain, the DNA, the grandmother, this and that. We obsess. That is the analysis. That's our analysis in the West. I'm not being rude. I'm just pointing it out. Buddha agrees that there is a past, but it's our own past. Our mind, tracking it back and knowing it well. This is the job of being a Buddhist. When we can get this, we can understand attachment and aversion. We can know why we are suffering and we can begin to have compassion for ourselves. And then we can begin to change. Then we can begin to have compassion. Then we can begin to transform problems and be happy to have problems. Because we're trying to get rid of them. And every time something triggers it, you're happy it's happening. That's advanced. I mean, that is advanced. Definite. Without this analysis, we can't understand the logic behind it, you know. And we can hugely misunderstand. Oh, I haven't got my iPad. But let's just say we did look at the 8 verses. I think it's in your course notes there. We won't go into it tonight, but I'll just mention. If we just out of the blue look at the 8 verses and you look at the second verse, and Langri Tampa advises us there to, when we're with others, we should see ourselves as the lowest of all. Not only that, we should see others as supreme. I mean, I joke, but I said before, but I don't joke. If you had never heard this before and you're in a crummy relationship with a lousy boyfriend who abuses you, you're a complete victim, you're full of pain and fear and depression and upset and have no idea about your own mind and feel like imprisoned in this nightmare, and for you to read that advice, for me to give you that advice, you could sue me, I promise. I'm not joking. It just sounds like, it's like insanity to say that to me because I'm not ready for it. I haven't even entered junior school yet. I haven't even begun to understand anything yet. So this advice is intense. You know, at the time in Tibet, these teachings in that verse, those 8 verses, were kept secret. Not just Tantra was kept secret. These amazing practices, you know, coming from our teacher, coming from the great Nalanda Monastery, marvelous practitioners, was kept secret. Because, as Milarepa said, Dharma is the exact opposite of the world. Whatever the world does, Dharma's opposite. This is like radical, radical opposite. And there's no logic to it, I tell you. So we have to understand where it all fits. What's the reasoning for this thinking? And who is capable of that? But Bhagavan Rinpoche says, in Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand, to do this level of practice, you've got to be a suitable vessel. And a suitable vessel to go to university is the person who's done high school and junior school. It's pretty clear. Which means you understand about karma, you understand about controlling your body and speech, you understand how to look at your mind, you understand delusions, you understand how that causes you suffering, and then you're practicing this. That qualifies you. That qualifies you. Without that inner work, we're not ready for this one. Don't even try it. It's silly. But our trouble is we romanticize spiritual teachings. We read all these texts and, oh yes, love all sentient beings, give myself to everybody, say blah, 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 blah. Haven't got a clue, you know. Are we communicating? Maybe silence means yes. Any questions before we go to bed? Any questions? I'm just touching on all things and then we're going to go into detail unpacking all this over the next few days. Any questions? Yes. I can't hear you, darling. I'm so sorry. Do we have the microphone, please? Where's our microphone, man? It's good to... Where's your streaming camera? I heard some people are watching on streaming. Where's the camera? Oh, listening, not video. Oh, okay. Well, hello, people. Happy to hear you. Happy to hear that you're there. Okay. Okay. Go, sweetheart. What's your question? Be closer to the mic.
Apart from walking around stupas and also doing prostrations, what are physical ways that one can enhance our mental practice?
We'll go to those, not tonight. I mean, they're necessary. What I will tell you, though, interesting is how is the frame is the way to understand those practices. It's very interesting. I think we get a bit confused about. It's a good question. It's a very good question. So, if, you know, when we say when we think of being a Buddhist, okay, we think of the general view of a Buddhist, especially Tibetan Buddhist. I mean, look at this. I mean, you know, there's more than the Catholics, isn't it? I mean, there's more holy pictures here than I had in my church. More holy pictures than I went to convent, when I went to the nuns, you know. More prayers. I do more prayers now than I did when I was a Catholic. We know that. So it's very typical to think of a Tibetan Buddhist as a person who is, you know, bald head, does prostrations, use their mala. You know, you see Tibetans, you know. I mean, I remember one time years ago in Tibet, some tourists were talking to a friend of mine who was a professor. She was a Buddhist professor. And in Tibet, you know, it's like a magical. It's like, you know, when I went with Lama Zopa, we're going to these monasteries and there were stories. Lama Zopa was telling us stories about statues that talked, statues that grew. There's Buddhas coming out of the rocks in the mountains. There's magical kind of mystery stories that you just can't believe, you know. He was talking all about this. So it sort of sounds like complete religion, Tibetans. They're unbelievable. So a tourist said to this friend of mine, an American Buddhist scholar, what do you like about being Tibetan Buddhist? She said, oh, all the logic and the analysis and the philosophy. Well, this woman nearly fainted. All she saw was this magical mystery tour, you know, of walking statues and talking this and magic and mystery. But this is the interesting point, because this we usually think that's religion. Then you have philosophy over here and you have psychology somewhere else. And this is what's so fascinating in the Tibetan, we understand this, in the Tibetan system, they're totally integrated. They're totally integrated, which is very fascinating. So the point is this, as I mentioned, you become a Buddhist when you start to work on your mind. That's where you become a Buddhist. That's where you do the actual job. The actual job of being a Buddhist is changing your mind from deluded, from non-virtuous to virtuous. That's the essence of the job from here to Buddhahood. Now, so then you think, well, if that's the case, why do I prostrate? Why do I live in vows? Why do I have to have a bald head and wear nun's robes and all this business, right? Like your question. It's a very good question. Well, an analogy for me is this. You guys play football, don't you? In Australia, we don't call it football. We call it soccer. It's second. It's like third class. Because real football is Australian football. And no one else in the world has ever heard of it. It's a very unique game in Australia, and they're totally fanatic. My team is the Sydney Swans. I remember the Dalai Lama one time, because their colours are red and white, and a bunch of Tibetans, Dalai Lama was given, one famous Australian footballer who played for Sydney, he offered something to the Dalai Lama. So all the monks, the Tibetan monks, liked Sydney because of that. You know, they liked the Sydney Swans. Anyway, my team, Sydney Swans. So, but you guys play football. I know you call it football here. So let's just, is there a famous Italian footballer who's good at getting goals? Who is there? Is there one? Is there one? Nobody knows. Well, I don't know. Who's a famous Italian footballer who gets goals? Who? Who? There's not. Well, forget. Who's a famous footballer, period? Who's a famous footballer who gets goals? Who? What? Francesco. Okay, let's just say Francesco. Let's say I go to football for the first time and I'm seeing this amazing guy get balls in the net with his head, with his whatever he wants. Do you understand? Let's just say, I imagine that. And I say, "May, amazing Francesco, please show me how to get the ball in the net." Now, this is a really simple point. It's true, isn't it, that the essence of soccer is the biggest number of balls in the net. Everything comes down to that. That's true, isn't it? The point of all of that drama is to get the biggest number. That's it. Well, So the essence of being is football is getting the ball in the net. Well, then I say to Francesco, "Please show me how to get the ball in the net." And we know perfectly well he'll say, "Well, first of all, Rabin, you've got to be 50 years younger. Then you've got to lose a lot of weight. And you've got to go to college for a couple of years and study football theory. You've got to go into teams. You've got to learn to jog. You've got to bounce the ball a million times and cook this and do that." And he'll say, no, you didn't hear me, Francesco. Francesco who? Francisco. Francesco. "Please, Francesco, show me how to get the ball in the net." And he'll repeat his answer. Because you know you can't just go get the ball in the net. You've got to do years of hard work. That's the same here. And that's why they call them preliminary practices, nondro. It is impossible because of the depth of our delusions, Buddha is suggesting, the depth of the habit of these delusions over countless eons, that just to simply go and do this job of work on your mind is impossible. Because our minds are so deluded. So we have to do masses of preliminary practices which are what purify our mind and train us to be able to change our mind. That's the function of all those practices. So, of course, we take these practices on as and when we're ready, you know. I mean, some people come into Tibetan Buddhism on the first day and just become a monk overnight and do all these things because they love it. They feel so familiar. Other people don't like. You've got to go in your own pace. But this is the way the Tibetan Lamas talk. The benefit of all the practices, especially that relate to the Buddha, this takes time for us to hear, because this just sounds like typical religion. But the function of the Buddha in any of our practices, because of the power of enlightened beings, because of their presence is so potent, and because of our connection, that any practice we do that bring in the Buddha are like huge, put atomic bombs under our old habits, you know, doing lots of purification practices, living in vows. We'll discuss all this in detail. Without living in vows, for example, this is junior school, it is not possible to get very far. Being good is not enough, as Lama Zopa says. And then we have to understand the psychology of vows. So one of the major tools we need is to live in vows. We can't get ahead of the game otherwise. Purification practices, absolutely massively important. We cannot get ahead of the game until we do purification as well. And all of this is taught in basic practices in junior school. The thing of practicing the ethics of controlling our body and speech in the framework of vows, in the framework of purification. This is how we can get ahead. This is the absolute basis. Then we're ready and prepared to go to the second scope, high school, and get concentration and begin to work on our mind. And then all that then prepares us to do the compassion wing. So there's logic to it. We have to understand the logic. And the fact is, if there's not logic to it, then don't do it. In Tsongkhapa's a Lamrim text called Songs of Experience, Rinpoche calls it Hymns of Experience. Tsongkhapa says, you know, there's all the teachings are to be taken as sound advice because there's no contradiction between scripture and practice. So what does that mean? Well, if you had a cookbook, it is true to say every word in this book, all the teachings, are to be taken as sound advice. Well, you know, if it's a cookbook, that's pretty obvious. You don't just read it out of interest. You read it because it's advice. Every single word in a cookbook is to help you get the cakes, to help you get the meal. This is logical. That's the nature of a cookbook. All the teachings are to be taken as sound advice. there is no contradiction between the recipe and the cake. That's true. If what is said in the recipe doesn't get you a cake, well, then it's insane. Chuck the book in the bin. Give it back and get your money back. It's a load of rubbish. So if there's anything in Buddhism, if there's one word, one syllable, one technique, anything at all that doesn't help you lessen your delusions and grow your goodness, it is meaningless garbage. Chuck it in the bin and give it and ignore it. This is a fact. There might be lots of practices, let's say, that Tibetans have literally created. They have. That's perfectly valid. That does not mean it's not Buddha's teachings, you know. I mean, Bach wrote that music when he wrote it. But people since Bach have learned certain things from that and have maybe created new exercises that Bach didn't create, but that help you play Bach. That's perfectly valid. Same with Buddhism. Lots of cultures do different things. They're just cultural. But that doesn't mean they're not logically based in Buddha's teachings. It's fundamentalist to say that only what Buddha said at that time in India is valid. That's just not true. Because people since the Buddha have become Buddha, you know. So if there is anything, let's say Tibetans have done, that is merely cultural, that has no basis in logic, that has no benefit, that doesn't help your mind lessen delusions and grow goodness, then it is a load of rubbish and don't do it. That's a fact. That's a fact. But we have to be the boss of that. That's why it's just not appropriate to blindly believe everything or simply copy what someone does, you know. It's Tibetan. We're not Tibetan. Okay, there's logic to things. There's logic even to sitting cross-legged. It's very Asian, it's true. But it is found in the teachings, you know. I remember the Dalai Lama said, His Holiness said one time, when he was giving instructions in the teachings about how to meditate, the position to sit. Tashi and I were discussing this. She's going to be teaching you meditation, leading your meditation tomorrow morning. But I remember His Holiness said, you know, that for the most advanced practices, there's something really meaningful and auspicious in having the legs in full lotus position. Like all the greatest yogis, you know. Like I remember Geshe Lama Khonchob. Did he come here? Geshe Lama Khonchob came here to teach? Never? Not here. So he's this amazing, he's one of Lama's, Yeshe's close friends, and he lived for years in Kopan, and when he left Tibet, he spent years and years up in the mountains, naked, no food, no sleep, no clothes, in meditation full time, in his little cave with no door on the front, you know, sitting naked there in 6 foot of snow in the winter. So he was in full lotus position, because when you're in full lotus position, there's something about that position that aligns all your subtler energy. So you can sit there for months on end without toppling over. So it's practical, you know. So His Holiness said one time, there is meaning to something that looks a bit Asian, like crossed legs. Like, who cares? Why should I cross my legs? There is some meaning to it. So, of course, if you can't, you don't. Don't worry about it. But I remember His Holiness said that if you can start your session just for a second in full lotus, it's really auspicious that creates the cause for you to be able to do it in the future, you know. But so what I'm saying is things might look Asian but have logic to them. So it's important we know these things, not just blindly follow whatever Tibetans do because it looks like the right thing to do, you know. It's like ridiculous. It's ridiculous, you know. We've got to understand what we're doing. It's time to go to bed. So I think we can have some silence. You staying here, all you people? Most of you staying here? Do you live in single rooms or dormitories? Have your own en suites with single rooms and everything? You don't have that here? No? What? Oh, very good. Well done. So anyway, what I'm getting at is, maybe it's nice for the evenings and the mornings to be silent. Silence is a really good practice. And we're going to do, one of the meditations we'll do is blessing the speech. I'm going to talk about, this is a junior school, we'll talk about speech. It's very powerful. So blessing the speech is very marvelous. And silence is a very good practice to help us purify our speech. So it's good to say from the evenings, from the time you leave this gompa, to go to your room, even if you're sleeping in the room with someone else, try and just give it a go. No one's going to police you, don't worry about it. But give it a go to be silent. It's like retreat mode. You go into yourself, maybe you read your notes, or you don't have notes, whatever, or you listen to something, you do your meditation, whatever you like, you know. But try and be silent. We often have a compulsion to speak as soon as there's someone with us. But sort of like, mind your own business. Kind of yogis look straight ahead, they say, you know. Until breakfast time, let's say. It's nice to do that. Give it a try. That's part of your homework. Keep silent. There's another piece of homework. Every night, when you hit the cushion, try and remember to say to yourself, may I see my dreams as dreams. Okay? There's something very auspicious about that, because when we see with dreams, we have no control. And then we wake up and we go, oh, it was just a dream. So what we're trying to do by even wanting to be in control of our dreams helps us learn to be in control of our lives, you know. We're mostly like not in control of our mind in our life either. And the other thing is, it's a nice analogy for how learning, as we learn more to progress spiritually and lessen the grip of ego grasping and attachment, we learn to see life as kind of, you know, more like a dream rather than so rigid, so powerful, so concrete, so serious, so up and down like yo-yos. It's very nice to do that, to see that you are dreaming when you're dreaming. And the other thing, the other piece of homework is, you know, you'll probably laugh now, if you wake up in the morning, and of course we all believe we will wake up in the morning, you see, one thing the Buddha's saying, like I mentioned briefly, but I will talk more, is our minds are full of all these misconceptions. There's all these emotional misconceptions, like the unhappy emotions, we talk about those, but we'll have all these other misconceptions. We grasp at ourselves as permanent. We believe things are inherent. We believe mummy made us. We believe our mind is the brain. We believe that God made us. I'm not being rude, but Buddha would say these are misconceptions. So we have lots of misconceptions in our mind that are the source of pain because they're not true. So one is, as Lama Zopa calls it, we grasp at permanent me. So, of course, we know perfectly well we will die at some point, but we do not believe we'll die tonight. That is a certainty. There's this nice story about this astrologer, Tibetan astrologer. There obviously must have been a person in the room with him when this happened to tell the story, but this is the story. It's a wonderful story. He's an astrologer, and he'd done his own chart, and it showed that he was going to die today. And he got a big shock, and he said, no, that's not possible. Where did I make a mistake in my analysis? He just assumed it was wrong. So apparently he's sitting with his arm on the windowsill or something, and there's this shutter, you know, and he's picking his ear with some pointy thing, and the shutter goes, and he goes, and he dies while he's contemplating where he made his mistake in his astrology analysis. Nobody laughed. Aren't you? Thank you. They're supposed to think that's funny. Shows how ridiculous we are. He truly believed he'd made a mistake. He didn't believe he was going to die today, you know, and that's how we all are, isn't it? So anyway, first piece of homework, try and be silent. Second piece of homework, as you hit the pillow, make a strong decision. May I see my dreams as dreams. Third piece of homework, when you wake up in the morning, notice it the second you come back into consciousness, okay? And you notice and you go, amazing, I'm still alive. And that means, we'll discuss this with karma, that means my petrol tank of morality hasn't run out yet. Literally is the main reason. So be so blissed out that you're not dead yet. So then you aspire, before you even get out of bed. May I hop out of bed, go to meditation, do what I can, come to the class, listen to Buddha's teachings, eat my breakfast, eat my lunch. Why? So I can develop my marvelous potential. Why? So I can be a benefit to others. Thinking like that, before you even get out of bed. That's it. And I'll see you tomorrow morning. So we just dedicate very briefly, thinking, all these seeds we've planted. Nothing goes astray, remember? All these seeds we've planted. As many thoughts as we've had as many seeds we've planted. So how marvelous. May we nourish these seeds from this moment forward so that we can develop our marvelous potential, so we can benefit others and make compassion. Bodhicitta, grow and grow. People want to, what page dedication prayers? What page dedication prayers? Just in case you want to join in. This is two, Gewadi and Jangchul. Anybody know what page? The dedication prayers? What page? 99. Okay, well, just if you want to join in. Otherwise, just think those thoughts. Yeah? Okay. Gewadin yududag lama sangge drugyune drowa chikyang malupa dei sala kapasho Jangchub semcho grinpoche ma kye panam kye gyuchig kye panyampa me payang gong ne gongdu pebashok. Okay. All right. Thank you. I'm going to sit here for a second, so you just go do what you like, okay? Kira, come see me. Okay, thank you. Come on, hang on a second. You take me home. You've got to go home now? Can you take me home when I go?